how many lawsuits he lost, and he lost scores of them. He was told over and over again in immense detail that the election was not stolen. There was no evidence of widespread fraud. It didn't matter. Donald Trump was confident he could persuade his supporters to believe whatever he said, no matter how outlandish, and ultimately that they could be summoned to Washington to help him remain president for another term.
From Vice Chair Liz Cheney to Benny Thompson, chair of the January 6th House Committee.
There can be no doubt that there was a coordinated, multi-step effort to overturn an election overseen and directed by Donald Trump. There can be no doubt that he commanded a mob he knew was heavily armed, violent, and angry, to march on the Capitol to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power. And he made targets out of his own vice president and the lawmakers gathered to do the people's work. These facts have gone undisputed. And so there needs to be accountability. Accountability under the law. Accountability to the American people. Accountability at every level, from the local precincts in many states where Donald Trump and his allies attacked election workers for just doing their jobs, all the way up to the Oval Office, where Donald Trump embraced the legal advice of insurrectionists that a federal judge has already said was a coup in search of a legal theory. Our democracy withstood the attack on January 6th. If there's no accountability for January 6th, for every part of this scheme, I fear that we will not overcome the ongoing threat to our democracy. There must be stiff consequences for those responsible.
That's House January 6th Committee Chair Benny Thompson speaking from isolation as he's tested positive for COVID-19. To see all eight of the committee's hearings in full, go to democracynow.org. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Kendall Northwest Launch Party on Thursday, July 30th from 5:45 p.m. to 11 p.m. at Jaja PDX in Portland. Kendall Northwest is a new circus and fine arts festival, including intro courses in the fire arts, fire spinning, live music, and competitive circus games. That's the Kendall Northwest Launch Party on Thursday, July 30th from 5:45 p.m. to 11 p.m. at Jaja PDX, 819 Southeast Taylor Street in Portland. That's the Kendall Northwest Launch Party on Thursday, July 30th from 5:45 p.m. to 11 p.m. at Jaja PDX, 819 Southeast Taylor Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon hospitals face renewed COVID strain. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declares a gun violence state of emergency. And in national news, California Governor Gavin Newsom will sign a gun control bill modeled after Texas's abortion ban. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 22nd, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. COVID spread and hospital strain have not faded in Oregon in the month of July. They've gotten much more severe. 21 Oregon counties are considered high risk by the CDC and recommended for their residents to wear masks indoors and take precautions for high-risk individuals. Oregon hospitals are struggling to operate normally, even though COVID hospitalizations are half what they were at the peak of the Delta wave last fall. Central and Southern Oregon in particular have been hit hard by staffing shortages and COVID hospitalizations. They've got few open beds, and staff have been working 16-hour shifts, sometimes without breaks, according to OPB. As of Wednesday, data shows only 7% of Oregon hospital beds are available. Hospitals are challenged on a number of fronts right now, financially, staffing, and their capacity. After 2 years of pandemic work, many nurses in particular are looking to leave the profession. In response, hospitals look to out-of-state travel nurses to fill in the gaps. They work for shorter contracts and higher pay than local nurses do. Oregon isn't alone in its COVID surge and hospital strain. The Washington State Hospital Association has many hospitals that are at 120 to 130% capacity, according to a recent report. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency over gun violence in a press conference yesterday. He has a new program called Safer Summer PDX, and the emergency declaration means that he can streamline the efforts of a number of programs across the city and its bureaus. The emergency declaration is in reaction to a dramatic increase in gun violence and deaths in Portland since 2019, a reversal of a few decades of trending down. A recent study by the California Partnership for Safe Communities estimated that a little over 200 Portlanders are responsible for the city's gun violence. Wheeler says the Safer Summer PDX program will focus on this group with social services and support rather than arrest and criminalization. In other cities, this model is called Ceasefire, and it's produced mixed results. It had significant successes in the 90s in reducing gun violence in places like Boston, Cincinnati, Chicago, Oakland, and Indianapolis, but OPB reports those changes can be short-lived. The rates of gun violence rebound even after this change. The emergency declaration also adds additional funding to programs that already exist from the city. This is the latest in a string of emergency orders from the Portland Mayor's office, which allow Wheeler to take control of programs that would not otherwise be under his purview. Portland is considering deploying a new technology that can detect gunshots, but critics say it may not help solve the issue of gun violence. Eric Tegedoff has more.
A police oversight group has formally recommended that Portland adopt a technology known as ShotSpotter to help tackle gun violence. But the technology has been met with some skepticism. ShotSpotter uses artificial intelligence with data collected from hidden microphones to determine the location of gunshots and inform the police department. Dan Hahn is a strategy consultant in government and civic technology based in Portland. He says the technology still has to make some leaps to determine if the sound it heard is a gunshot.
The thing about technology that we really need to understand is that it's not magical, it's not necessarily more reliable, it's not necessarily going to 100% always classify sounds in exactly the right way.
A study last year from Chicago, where ShotSpotter has been implemented, found it led to more than 40,000 dead-end police deployments over less than 2 years. The Focus Intervention Task Force Community Oversight Group submitted its recommendations to Mayor Ted Wheeler and the City Council on Monday. Hahn says if the technology is adopted, open data is key to ensure accountability. JMHE, with the organization Freedom to Thrive, points out the technology is still experimental and has even faced a challenge to its constitutionality as sole evidence in an Ohio case. One of the biggest criticisms is that it could lead to more policing in communities of color. Amechi thinks the resources that would be used to bring ShotSpotter to Portland should be used instead to improve lives in communities of color.
They instead use it to manipulate people into manufacturing consent for the surveillance system that puts more police into their neighborhoods. And we've seen already that more police in neighborhoods does not make us safer. It makes us actually more at risk of police violence.
A ShotSpotter spokesperson says communities affected by gun violence deserve a rapid police response, which gunshot detection enables regardless of race or geographic location. At a community meeting last week, ShotSpotter stressed that the technology would only be used to detect gunshots. But Chris Bushick, who heads the group PDX Privacy, believes the microphones could be used for other purposes.
I really want to believe them, but I've been disappointed many times by tech companies that have broken their promises. And there have been at least two criminal trials where prosecutors have tried to introduce into evidence voice recordings that were obtained from gunshot detection systems.
More than 120 cities are contracted with ShotSpotter, according to the company's website. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Washington State's Superintendent of Public Instruction wants to change where timber sales on state lands go. Union members in the state are hoping to ensure jobs aren't affected in the process. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Washington State's top education official is proposing a change to how timber revenue is used for schools. Unions are urging caution so the policy doesn't result in unintended consequences for workers. Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Rakedahl has proposed no longer using money from timber sales on state-owned lands for urban area school construction. Sarah Palmer is vice chair of the Natural Resources Policy Committee for the Washington Federation of State Employees, which represents staff in the Department of Natural Resources. She says policymakers shouldn't assume today is anything like the timber wars of the 1990s, which pitted urban versus rural areas.
Today it's a little more complicated. There's a little more nuance to it. And our members really feel that what we are doing at this time is sound, scientifically based land management. And we want that to continue to be a priority in the state of Washington for state trust lands.
Rakedahl is proposing the money from timber sales go to rural schools, as it has in the past, as well as sustaining healthy forests. He says it's harder and more expensive for rural communities to pass bonds for school construction than it is for urban communities. Palmer says prioritizing funding for rural schools is a positive development, but her union is waiting to hear more details on the proposal. She says there are concerns about how it could affect workers in her union, as well as a sister union, the Washington Public Employees Association, and mill and forest workers.
We really feel it is possible to balance economic needs and environmental needs and to find a middle path. We're really proud of the work that we do on that, and we're really proud of the work the department has done on that over the years.
Rakedahl is rolling out this and other policy recommendations so legislators can consider them next session. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
California Governor Gavin Newsom plans to sign a gun control law modeled after the controversial Texas abortion ban. That law allows private residents to sue abortion providers or even taxi drivers taking someone to an appointment for damages up to $10,000. The California bill adopts a similar model. Private citizens can sue anyone who makes, sells, or distributes illegal firearms for up to $10,000. It also has a provision that it will be overturned if and when the Texas law is nullified. Newsom may be setting up a Supreme Court challenge on the issue, but critics say with the way the Supreme Court has been ruling, the parallel between Texas's abortion law and California's gun control law might not get the same outcome. Just this session, the Supreme Court overturned a New York law that restricted concealed carry licenses. Shilipi Agarwal is the director at the ACLU of Northern California. They told the LA Times that they don't object to limiting access to illegal firearms, but quote, "The federal constitution creates the floor on our rights that states can't go below. That is what ensures that all citizens, no matter what state they live in, enjoy a baseline level of rights, which the courts then enforce." Agarwal continues, quote, "Texas's abortion ban is meant to create a trapdoor in that floor, and now other states are creating their own trapdoors. California is creating one as well, and with all of these trapdoors, the floor becomes meaningless." House lawmakers passed the Right to Contraception Act. A Georgia federal appeals court greenlights near-total abortion bans, and the White House says President Biden is in good spirits despite his COVID-19 diagnosis. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I don't know any member that has 10, 12, or 14 children. I'd say there's some family planning going on here. This is a private decision.
Democratic California Representative Anna Eshoo on the Right to Contraception Act, which House lawmakers passed on Thursday in a 228-195 vote, less than a month after Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas said the bench should reconsider the landmark case protecting forms of birth control. Eight Republicans joined all Democrats in supporting the measure. Most GOP lawmakers countered the law wasn't needed. Here's Washington State Republican Representative Kathy Morris Rogers.
Republicans have led to make birth control available over the counter. In 2019, the federal government under a Republican president spent $1.8 billion for family planning. We have solutions to build on this work to support women.
A federal appeals court in Georgia has ruled that the state's near total ban on abortions can take effect immediately. The law outlaws abortions once fetal cardiac activity is present and changes the definition of a natural person to include fetuses or embryos. Illinois Democratic Representative Jan Schakowsky on the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, paving the way for stricter state bans on abortion.
This extreme right-wing court that we have right now is not representative of what the American people want.
YouTube has announced it will globally remove content that promotes or provides instructions for unsafe or alternative abortion methods not supported by science or approved by medical professionals. The company will also remove false claims about abortion, such as that it commonly causes infertility or cancer. The White House on Thursday played down concerns about President Joe Biden's health hours after announcing that he had tested positive for COVID-19. Visiting Charlotte, North Carolina on Thursday, Vice President Kamala Harris said the president is capable of handling his job and is working from the White House residence.
He is in good spirits. He is feeling well. He is doing well. He is fully vaccinated.
Lawmakers held a hearing Thursday on the nation's rapidly rising home prices and how to help keep housing affordable. Vice President of the Center on Housing and Policy Priorities, Peggy Bailey.
Shortages of affordable housing single-family homes means that renters that might be ready for home ownership stay in rental housing longer, reducing vacancy rates and driving up rental costs.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will see those clouds turn clear with a low of 60 degrees overnight. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 80 degrees. Today in history, in 1937, the United States Senate votes down a proposal from President Franklin Roosevelt to add more justices to the Supreme Court of the U.S., commonly known as court packing. The quote of the day is from Canadian-American Jeopardy host Alex Trebek, who was born today in 1940. He said, quote, "The secret to happiness, of course, is not getting what you want, it's wanting what you get." In Arizona, a ballot measure this November would guarantee in-state tuition for all high school graduates, regardless of immigration status. If passed, it would also add access to public scholarships for undocumented and DACA students who've lived in the state for at least 2 years. Lily Bolke has more on Proposition 300.
This November, a measure to provide in-state tuition to all Arizona high school graduates, regardless of immigration status, will be on the ballot. Known as Prop 308, it would also ensure that DACA and undocumented students are eligible for public scholarships if they have been in the state for at least 2 years. A little over 2,000 undocumented and DACA students graduate from the state's high schools every year, and Jose Patino with the nonprofit group Aliento says they often have to pay 300% more than their peers at community colleges and 150% more at public universities.
The majority of the students who graduate who are undocumented DACA students just have this barrier that they can't overcome. And I pay for college because you're not eligible for traditionally how low-income students go to school through FAFSA, and you also are charged significantly more than your peers.
He notes some especially high-achieving students can get private scholarships, but thinks it's critical to expand access to college for all dreamers. 22 states allow undocumented residents to qualify for in-state tuition, and Patino hopes Arizona will soon join them. In 2006, Arizona lawmakers put another measure on the ballot, Proposition 300, barring undocumented students from accessing in-state tuition, and it passed. Prop 300 also prevented Dreamers from getting child care assistance or accessing literacy programs and adult education classes. But Patino says it makes no sense to stop any student from realizing their full potential through post-secondary education.
Education has transformational experience, specifically for first-time low-income students, first-generation students, where you not only are benefiting yourself, but you're changing the trajectory of your family.
He adds giving students a fair shot regardless of immigration status helps the economy. Undocumented immigrants in Arizona contribute hundreds of millions of dollars a year to federal, state, and local taxes. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Lily Wolke with Arizona News Connection.
An official apology for Indigenous people who endured the residential school era in Canada may be on the horizon as the Pope is set to visit this week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Pope Francis is set to arrive in Canada on Sunday for an official six-day visit. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, there are high expectations of an official apology on Canadian soil to Indigenous people for the wrongs done by the Catholic Church during the residential school era.
In the lead-up to the trip, the pontiff sought prayers for his penitential Canadian pilgrimage. Indigenous people are looking for this visit to bring healing and even action as the Catholic Church has failed to raise all the money it promised to compensate the survivors of residential schools. Rose LeMay is the CEO of the Indigenous Reconciliation Group.
My fear is that the apology will be words alone, and there has been so many requests for the Catholic Church to do good on its settlement, residential school settlement payment.
Also at issue are documents still held by the church relating to the residential schools and for those responsible for the schools to be held accountable. The Pope is scheduled to arrive in Edmonton on Sunday. The following day, he will meet with members of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. Tuesday, he will celebrate Mass at Commonwealth Stadium in Edmonton, then take part in a pilgrimage to Lac Ste. Anne, likely to be the largest annual Catholic gathering in Western Canada. Wednesday, he flies east to Quebec City, where he will meet the Governor General and the Prime Minister, and on his final day, he will travel north to Iqaluit and meet with students of former residential schools. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Inuit Circumpolar Council wrapped up its three-day General Assembly meeting on Thursday. The non-governmental organization represents Inuit peoples from four Arctic nations. As Emily Schwing reports, Greenland will assume the chairmanship of the ICC for the next 4 years.
International Chair Daly Sambo-Durow of Alaska handed over leadership of the Inuit Circumpolar Council to Greenland's Sarah Olsvig.
Congratulations, Sarah.
Olsvig served in both Denmark's and Greenland's parliaments between 2011 and 2018. She's also a member of Greenland's Human Rights Council and Constitutional Commission. She gave a brief speech to ICC delegates from Alaska, Canada, Chukotka, and Greenland.
We are crossing uncharted waters. The pandemic has changed the conditions under which we work, and the new geopolitical reality puts pressure on us as a people and to the world around us, and on the Arctic as a whole.
Olsvig says international security and safety for ICC members, including those from Chukotka in Russia's Far East, is a priority as Russia continues its war in Ukraine.
Many Indigenous peoples around the world, especially those that are human rights defenders, have challenges. And as an Arctic people, we Inuit are acutely and painfully aware of the difficult situation that we are in. And we are in it collectively across the four nation states that we live in, and we are going to row our boat slowly and in a careful manner in the years to come to make sure that we are all in the boat.
She also plans to continue the ICC's focus on formal participation within the United Nations, including in both the Food and Agriculture and International Maritime Organizations, to address concerns about food security and the impacts of increasing industrial marine traffic in the Arctic. Olsvig says engaging Inuit youth perspectives in that work is paramount. An Emerging Leaders Initiative has provided the ICC's Executive Council with recommendations that outline those expectations. The ICC will hold an in-person gathering next summer in Ilulissat, Greenland. I'm Emily Schwing.
Support for this story is from the Climate Justice Resilience Fund. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
One of the most recognizable species in North America is now considered endangered by a leading global authority on the status of the natural world. The migratory monarch butterfly has seen huge population declines. Mike Mullen has more with a Minnesota city that's committed to reversing this trend.
An insect commonly seen flying through gardens is now closer to extinction. The migratory monarch butterfly has landed on an endangered species list and a Minnesota city hopes other communities join the movement to save it. This week's announcement is from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which says the popular orange and black monarch has seen population declines between 22% and 72% in the past decade. It cites climate change, development, and pesticides as key factors. North Mankato Mayor Mark Dean has helped to lead habitat restoration in his city.
With that big migratory process that they go through each year, it's just a clear example of whether or not we are promoting a healthy environment for the wildlife and the pollinators and ultimately for us as human beings.
After winter hibernation, the monarch migrates from Mexico all the way to Canada, with states like Minnesota in the migration corridor. Several years ago, North Mankato joined the National Wildlife Federation's Mayor's Monarch Pledge. Beyond habitat work, it calls on local leaders to educate residents about what they can do to create butterfly habitat. Locally, Dean says some of their work has involved prairie restoration in the city's larger parks and a new ordinance that allows for more natural yards on private property. He says while this week's news is disappointing, North Mankato's efforts provide some hope.
It's nice to see the butterflies and the monarchs floating around our environment now as we're seeing them move from our parks and about the area. So to me, that's at least an observational sign that we are having some impact on our local pollinators.
He says prior to these efforts, land changes had reduced the amount of milkweed in the area. The plant is a key food source for the monarch. Dean says they've worked with local libraries to distribute milkweed plants to North Mankato residents for their gardens. Mike Bowen, Minnesota News Connection.
Erosion, storm damage, and sea level rise threaten tiny islands off the Texas Gulf Coast. Audubon, Texas works to keep island bird sanctuaries from losing ground. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Off the Texas Gulf Coast, a string of tiny islands, many uninhabited by people, provide important habitat for water birds. Egrets and herons make nests in trees and shrubs, while terns and black skimmers nest on the shores.
Some islands have like tens of birds, other islands have tens of thousands of birds returning to them each year.
Alexis Baldera is with Audubon, Texas, which owns or leases more than 175 of these islands so they can be maintained as bird sanctuaries. Most of the islands are man-made, created out of dredged sediment during the construction of the Intracoastal Waterway. Over the decades, birds have increasingly used them as nesting grounds because they are safe from predators and human disturbance. But the islands are losing ground to erosion, heavy storm damage, and sea level rise.
It's a huge impact, and without any sort of restoration of the islands that are there, some of our bird sanctuaries will be underwater.
So Audubon and its partners are adding more dredged sediment to some of the islands to increase their elevation and keep pace with sea level rise. Baldera says that making these islands higher will help maintain the nesting habitat that the birds now depend on. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
President Biden made his first trip to the Middle East last week. He accomplished some of his narrow goals, but he didn't end up breaking with tradition, not really addressing many of the issues in these relations. Now, we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. President Biden has now completed his first visit to the Middle East. The trip was billed as an opportunity to reset relations, especially with Saudi Arabia, and reaffirm traditional U.S. policy on Israel and the Palestine question. In those narrow senses, Biden accomplished his mission, yet he did nothing to break with tradition. What he mainly did was to discard some of the worst features of Trump's Middle East policy. In an op-ed for the Washington Post prior to his trip, Biden said, quote, "From the start, my aim with Saudi Arabia was to reorient, but not rupture, relations with a country that's been a strategic partner for 80 years. Biden must contend with a leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who, U.S. intelligence has concluded, ordered the assassination of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, dazzled Trump and Jared Kushner with his wealth, made never-fulfilled promises of arms purchases and increased oil production, and carried out a terribly destructive war in Yemen with U.S. logistical and weapons support." How well did Biden do on those issues? While Biden greeted Salman with a fist bump, he says he personally blamed Salman for the Khashoggi murder. The Saudis denied that, and Biden moved on. On Yemen, Biden says the Saudis are now obeying a truce and that Yemenis now enjoy their first peace in several years. But the Saudis have promised to stop their bombing of Yemen before, only to resume when the Americans' attention was elsewhere. As for the Saudis stepping up oil production as a contribution to lowering gas prices here, no such arrangement was announced. As in the past, the Saudis are mainly responsive to markets and money-making opportunities for them. Right now, they're busy, along with the Chinese, buying up cheap Russian oil. The Crown Prince doesn't seem the least interested in helping a Democratic president who has publicly reviled him as a pariah. Biden also met with leaders of eight other Arab countries, including President el-Sisi of Egypt, where tens of thousands of political prisoners are locked up as part of a crackdown on dissent. Biden's spokesman said he will bring up human rights with every leader that he meets with. Sure, but eight of the nine countries had unelected leaders who show little tolerance for dissent. What they want is more U.S. weapons to keep their citizens under wraps, and they'll probably get them. Regarding Israel, Biden was, of course, far more forthcoming with Israel than with the Palestinians. Except for disagreement on Iran, it was the usual show of partiality toward Israel and hopefulness of a two states, two peoples solution to the conflict. Biden met with President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority and expressed the, quote, hope that Palestinian children will, quote, one day enjoy the same freedom and self-determination as their neighbors. But he gave no indication that the U.S. would take initiatives to help realize that hope, or at least restore political and humanitarian support of the Palestinians that Trump had ended. As for Iran, although Biden upheld support for restoring the nuclear deal, he also, and needlessly, bowed to Israel's hardliners by promising to attack Iran's nuclear facilities if diplomacy fails. That was a particularly short-sighted comment, given the importance of the nuclear deal, not just for forestalling any Iranian effort to build a bomb, but also for removing sanctions on Iran's oil exports, which could benefit the U.S., and for possibly forestalling Iran's sales of drones to Russia for use against the Ukrainians. If we're writing up a balance sheet on Biden's trip, the positives are